Okay, folks, before we start today's show, we want to give a big shout out to our sponsor, Texas Coin. Right now, that Texas coin is sitting right at $3.16, and that's right now on September 10th, 2025. They're hashing right there in the great state of Texas, right out about 400 gigahertz. And I tell you, right now, they have already signed up 23,793 miners. And you'll recall, I signed up about a month ago. There was only 12,000, so it's practically doubled. They're signing up about 350 a day to mine that Texas coin. Hey, if you want to get in on this and learn more about it, just shoot an email to texitmines@gmail.com. That's TEXITMINES@gmail.com. And go ahead and shoot that. Put the word palm in there somewhere, like in the subject line, P-A-L-M, like a palm tree, to get that discount. And we hope you enjoy today's show.
Hello there, and welcome to the Palm and Pine Podcast. The boys are coming to you from their hidden camp, set deep in the Florida woods on the banks of the Mystic Suwannee River. So let's take a moment and hear from the boys of old Florida.
All right, folks, welcome to the Palm and Pine Podcast. We are glad to be with you, and we have a great show set up for today. We are going to get way deep into some Florida, unique Florida things and some Florida history, always, always unique to only our state. And we're great to have. We have a great guest that's going to kind of unveil a lot of this for us. And as always, I'm here with Professor Barlow. And good morning, Professor Barlow. Why don't you go ahead and key this up for us and introduce this great guest.
Good morning. Good morning. Happy to be here September the 1st on a Labor Day. Steve, I'm just so excited about the guest we have with us today. I could not sleep last night. We've been trying to get this guy on. He was recommended to us by Aubrey Brown from Florida Folk History. Mr. Tom Cook, better known as Stingray Tom, and he has a fabulous YouTube channel, Stingray Tom's Florida. Please go check that out, where he discusses the history of tourism in Florida, and not just the Disney stuff. He goes back and studies the tourism industry before Disney. And so Tom is a prolific writer and photographer, and it's just a storehouse of information to get into his YouTube channel and look at that. So we're so happy to have Stingray Tom with us today. So welcome to the Palm and Pine Podcast, Tom Cook.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Really looking forward to this.
Great, great. Well, tell us a little bit about your background, your coming to Florida, your interests, and how that evolved into you having this YouTube channel about the history of tourism in Florida.
Well, I grew up in South Florida, close to Lake Okeechobee, down in the Stuart Martin County area. And from the earliest days down there, my family and I would travel around the state of Florida, going to what are now the old attractions, Silver Springs and Cypress Gardens and Weekiwachee and places like that. And of course, like everyone else, I absolutely loved those places. But unlike most other people, I would always hold on to the brochures and maps and anything else that they had available. I would look in the gift shop for any kind of souvenir books and stuff like that. And we always tried to get those. And so that started sort of a collection that I've been keeping on with for the last 50 years or so. To basically, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was saving history in a way that a lot of other people never paid much attention to it. As a historian, most historians end up focusing on one specific subject of time or place, and spending a great deal of time researching that, because it's really fun to get into the weeds of the history of a place instead of just sort of shooting all over the world and trying to do a little bit here, a little bit there. And so my focus has ended up being Florida history, specifically the tourism. And the main reason I do that is because, well, the main reason I love it is the main reason I do it. But the secondary reason is that things like tourism aren't taken all that seriously by most historians. Not that they think it's completely frivolous, but most historians tend to focus on wars and major other conflicts and the history of civilizations and all sorts of other stuff like that. That's like very heavy stuff. And they don't really consider tourism to be that important. And yet, you know, in the state of Florida, it's the largest industry that we have. And it has been the largest industry for many, many years. And so many innovations have come out of Florida when it comes to tourism that it's an important story to tell as a historian.
Right, great, right. Well, you've studied a lot of, as I said, pre-Disney tourism attractions in Florida, and that's fascinating. A lot of people don't know that tourism really goes back to the 19th century with Ocklawaha River tours. Could you tell us of these smaller attractions that you've studied pre-Disney, yes, the one that is most surprising to you that you've ran into?
I'm having problems.
Oh, well, so many of them are surprising. I think the biggest ones, the most important earliest ones are the ones that are actually in St. Augustine. And in many cases, they're still there today. You're looking at, we really wouldn't call them tourist attractions at the time, but there are places like the Fountain of Youth Park, which of course we know that the Fountain of Youth doesn't exist in Florida, but there's a park dedicated to that story and the indigenous population that lived in that area and basically the history of St. Augustine. And that that attraction essentially goes back close to 150 years. And so that's a really important aspect. The other parts of St. Augustine, like the Castillo de San Marcos and the oldest house and the oldest wooden schoolhouse and places like that, really speak to a lot of history and are still popular tourist places today. But when you're talking about things like the Ocklawaha River, which is a tributary of the St. John's, you're also talking about the riverboats, the steamships that would come down the St. John's River from Jacksonville. Jacksonville ended up being a major passenger port. And one of the things you could do when you came to Florida, in fact, one of the few things you could do when you came to Florida was get on a smaller paddle wheel steamer and take it down the St. John's and eventually go on the Ocklawaha if you wanted to, but you would also go to the Silver River, which is the tributary that feeds into the Ocklawaha, but starts off at Silver Springs, which is one of the largest natural springs, not only in Florida, but in the entire world. And Silver Springs basically developed as a tourist attraction back in the 1840s, 1850s. But back then it was mostly for swimming and canoeing and just having fun like that, like most springs are today. But what ended up happening was that the developers there came up with the idea of having glass bottom boats. And in the 1870s or so, it's generally accepted that they developed glass bottom boats. A lot of people like to say that they invented glass bottom boats. They may have invented their own, but I don't know if they were the first people to put, you know, sheets of glass in the bottom of a boat. That seems like something pretty generic. But that really turned them into a tourist attraction because they now had something that was less than natural. That it wasn't just swimming and canoe paddling and stuff.
Well, you know, speaking of pre-Disney, I have this fascinating book, Images of America, Levy County, and there's, you might not be able to see, but there's a picture in there of a Suwannee River, a jungle drive, and there's this huge arrow. It would have been on the side of the road on US 19. From the car there, it appears to be in the 1940s. So there were these quirky small attractions around Florida pre-Disney, and we had one in our area called Dogland, which claimed to have the largest collection of dog breeds in the world. And this was pre-Disney as well. Of course, this park is long gone. I don't even know where to place where it is now. How did Disney change things for these smaller, quirky attractions?
Disney completely radicalized the tourist market in Florida. And really, I mean, with the start of Disneyland radicalized, it changed it completely in the 50s as well for the entire country. When Disney came, all bets were off when it came to what the smaller attractions were going to be able to do. It had already started in the early 60s with the interstates. A lot of people blame the interstates and the Florida Turnpike for basically killing off so many of the smaller attractions. And that's true to some extent. But of course, like everything else in history, it's a more complicated story than that. But because people weren't driving as much on the old highways like US 27, US 17, US 1 and US 19, the attractions that were basically on those roads to make money by the people who were passing by ended up having more problems because less people were going by. And Disney just exacerbated that by giving everybody in the United States a destination 100% of the time. No longer were people looking at a destination of going to Miami, but taking two or three days through Florida in order to get to Miami. And those two or three days they would spend at the different various parks and attractions along the way, whichever road they chose to drive. Now people were driving straight into Florida and going to Disney. And that just changed everything because there was enough stuff to do at Disney and right around Disney very early on that people weren't exploring the rest of the state nearly as much as they had before. So that really impacted a great deal of the attractions. And we really consider the golden era of Florida tourism to be the 50s and 60s, essentially ending in 1971 when Disney opened.
Right. Now, from that golden era, is there one now defunct attraction that you would love to bring back that was like the neatest? If you could bring one of them back, which one would it be?
Well, I have a soft spot for Six Gun Territory, which was a attraction that was in Silver Springs. It was not part of Silver Springs. It was like a mile and a half away from it, but definitely was built there because Silver Springs was there and had all that major attraction. Six Gun Territory, as you might guess, if you're not familiar with it, was an attraction.
Tom, we went there many times when we were kids.
Oh, okay, great.
Many times.
A lot of your listeners probably never heard of it because, of course, it closed many years ago.
Yes.
I find that one particularly interesting because it really shows one of the creative ways that Florida residents created attractions back in the day, in that they didn't necessarily pay any attention to the fact that they were in Florida. There were some, of course. I mean, Gatorland and the St. Augustine Alligator Farm focused great deal on Florida culture and Florida animals and stuff like that. Cypress Springs was the same way. But you got a place like Six Gun Territory, which is totally focused on the myth of the Old West and focused also on the popularity of Westerns on television and the movies at the time. And so it had an entire town of basically a Western town that had shootouts and bank robberies and live shows in the saloon and an Indian village and a Mexican cantina and all sorts of fantastic stuff like that. And it's a shame that it no longer exists. The good news is that, and I don't know if you know about this, but there's a farm in Kirby Family Farm in Williston, which is west of Silver Springs, Ocala, that has a fair amount of the old stuff from the park, including the train. And they do fundraisers for children in need. So they have Six Gun Territory weekends a few times a year and stuff like that. So they have basically recreated a town. They have a lot of the old performers from Six Gun that are volunteers at this new place. And it's not really an attraction because it's not open on a regular basis, but they're keeping Six Gun territory alive to some extent. And I think that's pretty fantastic.
Well, that's great. And that's a great choice, Tom, because as a kid, we loved Six Gun territory. We thought it was a better deal than Disney World. And we love the fact that you paid one fee and, you know, in the back of the place, they had this huge park of rides and you could just ride them all day long once you paid that fee. So we always as kids loved it much better than Disney World. And I had kind of wondered what had happened to it. So that's interesting to know.
Yeah. And that Six Gun territory might have been part of the reason why Disney eventually shifted from tickets to a flat fee to get into the park and do whatever you want. There was early on some fairly good competition with Six Gun Territory and Disney because Six Gun Territory was well known and it was popular at the time. So we believe that there's a likelihood that when Disney decided to change their pricing policies in the late 70s, that one of the reasons they did that was Six Gun. Unfortunately, that also was around the time when Six Gun was starting to run down and eventually closed. So,
right. Well, obviously, you've also done a lot of work in relation to Disney World and their history coming to Florida in the late 60s, and you've dug into that. So as you've dug into that, tell us some very surprising things you learned that maybe the general public would not know about the creation of Disney World in Florida.
Well, one of the things that I think is really interesting is, the story of how Disney decided on moving to Central Florida and picking the spot they did is based on the story of Walt Disney and his brother Roy and other executives of the Disney company taking a airplane and flying around Central Florida. And at some point, Disney looked down and decided, Walt Disney looked down and decided that his park should be near where the intersection of Interstate 4 and the Florida Turnpike would be. Now, we know that that is true. We know that story is true because there's a number of people that were on that plane, and they all basically agree to that, and it makes sense. But what people don't often know is that Walt and Roy spent a great deal of time in Central Florida as kids and as young adults. Their mother was from Lake County. She was born north of Mount Dora, basically, and in a little town called Paisley. And their father was down in that area at the turn of the century, and he met the future wife. They fell in love and they got married down here in Central Florida. Now they moved away to Chicago before the kids were born. So Walt Disney wasn't born here, but they came back on a regular basis to visit their relatives, of course, like most people would. His mother's family was down here still in the Paisley Kismet area. Elias Disney even worked in Kissimmee for a while before he moved away. So people like to talk about that Disney decided on Central Florida just sort of randomly as a good place because it was an easy place for people to get to. But he actually knew the people and he knew what the land was like back then. So he had a deeper understanding of what Central Florida would mean to turning it into a theme park and basically a vacation area. And if you sort of move forward, I think one of the most fascinating things that I've recently did a video on were the trash cans in the theme parks and on Disney property. And now, for people who aren't really into Disney, that may sound like a very strange thing to talk about, trash cans, because nobody ever pays attention to trash cans. But with Disney trash cans, if you're a Disney fan, you know that there's some sort of strange backstory about trash cans. if you were to Google 30-foot rule, Disney and Trash Can, you would come up with website after website after website who talks about this 30-foot rule that exists in Disney parks about how far trash cans have to be placed apart from each other. And they will generally say that Walt was the person who came up with that rule. Now, of course, they never give you the wording of the actual rule. They never give you any evidence that the rule ever existed. And of course, if you talk to the actual people who know what they're talking about, you'll know that there is no 30-foot rule. There has never been a 30-foot rule. And the easiest way to figure that out is you just take a look in the parks, like I have, and you measure the distance between trash cans, and there's nowhere near any kind of equanimity about the distance between them. Some of them are 90 feet, some of them are 100 feet, some are only 20 feet apart. So I really love digging into things like that, that are assumptions that people make. People just keep sharing the same story over and over again, never bothering to look at if there's any evidence for it. The real story is that Disney decided early on that in order to make his park clean and a place that families and children would want to go, is that he needed to make sure that there was a lot less trash on the ground than there was everywhere else in America at the time. And so he put trash cans basically everywhere he could. The whole concept, and you can even see it in the parks today, is that if you're walking down a path in any of his parks, you should be able to see a trash can within 20, 30 feet of you up as you're walking past it. And if you turned around and started going the other way, there should be another one 30, 40, or 50 feet away. If it makes a lot more sense for people to be responsible in throwing away trash if you give them a place to throw it away. And that's all that whole concept of the 30-foot rule really actually meant.
Well, that's great. And you kind of debunked the myth. Let me give you another myth or rumor that we've always heard. We've always heard that when Disney bought up the property in that area, it was just cattle pasture. And they hid this buying behind different shell companies so that people would not know that it was Disney buying the land. And eventually they caught them and the price went up, and that they would hide. They would leave an indirect route. They wouldn't go directly back to LA when they flew out, and all these kind of almost like spy games we've heard. Is there any truth to all of that?
Absolutely. that is a pretty real story. Yes. Disney knew, and you know, the Disney name was of course world famous back then in the early 60s. And so Disney knew that as soon as anybody realized that Disney was interested in property, the price would go through the roof. So Disney did develop shell companies, basically small companies that were subsidiaries of the Disney company, so that they could buy various pieces of property. They then generally bought small lots. They bought them separate from each other so that one company wouldn't necessarily be buying a piece of property right next to another piece of property and have those two owners be able to talk and say, well, the same company bought my stuff. And yes, they did it because they wanted to keep the price down. Now, the big thing, and the one thing you started out with, was talking about it being cattle land. Most of that property was not even good enough to graze cattle on. That area is extremely swampy. It's on the edge of the green swamp over in Lake County, and it was all but useless land. So there were a few homesteaders on it and a few people who had small farms, stuff like that, but it was essentially not developed in any way, shape, or form because it was just too wet. So Disney was actually buying essentially worthless land, and they felt that they should buy it for the value of that worthless land. So, they did play a little bit of tricks on people because of that. But once again, I mean, if you're going to artificially inflate something because it's a wealthy company coming in, that's not really any nicer than somebody basically hiding the fact that they're a wealthy company.
Now, you're a prolific nature photographer. Tell us about some of your favorite spots around Florida for nature photography.
Oh, there's so many. Everglades, of course, is the best of all places. It's just so beautiful down there and so flat. And there's just so many animals down there. But closer to Central Florida, one of my favorite places is the Circle B Bar Ranch, which is south of Lakeland. It's part of the Polk County park system. And it is this wonderful place. It used to be a cattle ranch, Circle Bar. I always have trouble remembering if it's Circle B Bar or Circle Bar B. It doesn't really matter. If you look up that, obviously you're going to find it. It's a great place to do some hiking. There is a huge lake next to it. There's tons of alligators on the property. You're always going to see alligators sunning themselves. You may be walking across one of the walkways, and an alligator will cross right in front of you. There's tons of birds down there, all sorts of waterfowl. There's it's a great place to walk. All the paths are flat and well created, so that moms with strollers go down there to check it out. It's just a terrific place. So it's one of my favorite places to go. There's also one of the things that we've started to realize in the last 20 years is that that there are some places that aren't technically nature oriented that are great places to see nature. Gatorland Zoo and the like I mentioned before, as well as the Alligator Park in St. Augustine, in the spring are wonderful places to see nesting birds. They both have have boardwalks that go through a heavily treed area, a swampy area. And they're places that wood storks and spoonbills and all sorts of herons and egrets and several other types of birds, they nest in it every spring. And you will see hundreds and hundreds of these birds. And depending on what time you go between March and May, you're going to see various birds who have nested and who have either eggs in that you can literally see in their nests from 10 feet away, or you'll see those chicks that come out of the eggs and they're feeding them. And it's noisy, it's raucous. The wood storks are the noisiest birds when it comes to being in a colony. And so places like that, which are, of course, very accessible by just about anybody, are really fantastic places to see Florida nature up close and personal.
Right. If we might go back to St. Augustine, you know, as a kid, you know, we went to Six Gun Territory, but we also made that pilgrimage to the Fountain of Youth in St. Augustine. And I guess that's one of the legacy tourist attractions that has hung on, and it's probably bigger than ever now, just going to St. Augustine. How far does that go back? When is it that they realized this city had tourism potential?
Well, it's tough to say. I talk about how it basically started as a tourist location around the time that the United States took control of Florida in 1821. There were definitely visitors. You look at people like William Bartram with the Bartram Trail that we have today. He was an explorer and naturalist who took a trip through a lot of northern Florida. And so you could call him a tourist, but he was also really just an explorer and scientist as well. So he wasn't doing it just for fun. He was doing it to learn more about Florida. But after that, in 1821, what really changed was that all of a sudden, Florida became, instead of a foreign country, it became part of the United States. And everybody in the rest of the United States suddenly had a place that was reasonably accessible, that was safe to go to, that was semi-tropical and weird and unusual and stuff. You could, you know, the whole concept of taking a boat down the St. John's River to go to a place like St. Augustine, which was basically a non-American city in Florida, So I really talk about that. That's when tourism technically started, although people, of course, were visiting Florida for interest before that. So when you look at 1821, you're looking at various guest houses being opened up. One of them is the Jimenez Facio House. I did a video on that, a couple of videos on that, actually. That is one of the first guest houses in all of the state of Florida, but especially in St. Augustine, and how today it's a museum, and you can actually see the bedrooms where visitors stayed and spent like the winter and stuff like that for between 1821 and the 1850s and so. Then, you know, the entire town was basically developed, was basically created into a tourist attraction to some extent because the place was so exotic. It was the only Spanish place in the eastern part of the United States to have any kind of real interesting aspects. And some of the houses go back into the early 1700s and are almost as old as the houses up in New England in the Boston area. And then you have the Castillo de San Marcos, which is just a remarkable structure. It's the oldest masonry fort in North America and the only place really in the United States that is older than St. Augustine itself is San Juan in Puerto Rico, because, of course, the Caribbean was developed by the Spanish before they started really developing any other place in like a mainland. So St. Augustine has been for many, many years, basically its entire life under an American flag, has been a tourist attraction.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. That goes way back. Well, I have to ask, Tom Cook, Stingray Tom, how did you get the name Stingray Tom?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because I actually just got a message on my one of my YouTube posts, my video on the Dixie Highway. It basically said, well, you know, it started out basically saying that Stingray Tom was obviously some moniker that somebody from the North who recently moved to Florida chose for himself to make himself sound more Floridian. I'm not sure how Stingray Tom has to do with Florida's per se, because basically every subtropical and tropical water around the world has stingrays. So it's not like this is a particularly Florida thing, but what he said was kind of off the mark. I did grow up in California. I was a kid in California before my family moved to South Florida. But that was many, many years ago. And so while I'm not a native Floridian, I might as well be, because I've been here for nearly 50 years and I've been studying the state of Florida forever and ever. The name Stingray Tom came from when I was a photographer at SeaWorld a bunch of years ago, believe it or not. And it ended up becoming sort of this weird stage name. It was never a nickname. The other thing he implied was that I gave myself this nickname. And while I did sort of roundabout choose the name itself, what ended up happening was that when I was a photographer and was taking pictures of families, I would often tell the kids to go over to Stingray Lagoon in the park and check out the stingrays, because I still think it's one of the neatest things you can do in any attraction in the state of Florida, which is literally lean over and pet live stingrays. And so I would tell people go to Stingray Lagoon. And because I still have some of a carnival barker in me, I guess, I would tell people and say, and by the way, tell them Stingray Tom sent you. They said, they know me there. And of course, it was just a complete joke, because stingrays don't know you and stuff like that. But later on, sometimes during the day, I'd be photographing people in a different part of the park. And one of those kids would come up to me and say, hey, you're Stingray Tom. We visited your stingrays and said hi for you. So it became sort of this thing where I was known as Stingray Tom. I never expected anyone to call me that. But then when I started the YouTube channel, of course, I needed some name that would be interesting and hopefully somewhat explanatory of what I do. And so I decided to call it Stingray Tom's Florida. It kind of implies that it's a fun thing. No one's going to take a guy named Stingray Tom all that seriously. I mean, I'm not going to be, yeah, okay, head of NATO, here's Stingray Tom, you know. So I figured that would be good. It would focus on my interest and love of nature, as well as the fact that I'm talking about the history of Florida. So it's one of those things. I don't consider it a nickname. It's more of a stage name than anything else, I guess.
Well, great. I'm glad I asked that question. That was a very interesting response. Well, Tom Cook, Stingray Tom, it's been so great to have you on. So much to talk about. We'll have to have you back on sometime. Do you have anything new you're working on right now? We'll send folks to your YouTube page, but do you have anything new you're working on right now you want to tell our listeners about?
It's funny. Probably just like you, I think a lot of YouTube and video creators, stuff like that, are working on multiple things in the background all the time, because you never know what's going to necessarily fall into place or right time, stuff like that. Right now, one of the videos that I'm putting together is about Chalet Suzanne, which was a place, a restaurant and an inn in the Lake Wales area, not far from Bock Tower. It's a fascinating place. It started in the 30s and it ran up until just a little over a decade ago. And now it's actually owned by a connected with the original family, but is now a drug rehab center, for like a live-in center for people who have addictions to drugs, which is an awesome thing to have in the first place. But Chalet Suzanne was this funky little place. Some people called it sort of a cross between a Swiss chalet and a Peter Pan village. But what really has gotten me interested right now is that they used to make soups and were famous for soups. And one of the soups they made was called soup romaine. And that soup was so popular that a couple astronauts loved it so much from eating it there that they talked NASA into allowing them to take it on one of the moon missions. It went on Apollo 16. And then it was so popular, it went on Apollo 17 as well. So you've got this soup from the Chalet Suzanne in Central Florida that had made it to the moon, which is just this remarkable story. And the really little interesting twist that I like is that it was originally called, soup romaine, but now it's known as moon soup because of the obvious connection. But people argue back and forth as whether it actually was a soup that was made with romaine lettuce or not. Now, the soup that went to the moon and that was canned by the company was actually made with spinach instead of romaine lettuce. Which makes much more sense that way. But I've seen it go both ways, that there is an argument that it was called soup romaine because it started out being used with romaine lettuce. So what I'm going to do in a video is I'm going to try and figure out if soup romaine made with romaine lettuce is any good, and if it's better or not as good as soup romaine made with spinach. So I'm going to make a batch of both of those as best that I can, and just do a taste test.
Oh, gosh. Well, we'll be looking forward to that. So, Tom Cook, Stingray Tom, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed today's episode of the Palm and Pine Podcast. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. The views and opinions expressed by the host or any guest are our own and do not necessarily reflect the views of any affiliates. Our opinions are just that, opinions, and are not legal or medical advice. But in our opinion, avoid lawyers and big pharma at all cost. Copyright 2025, Palm and Pine Podcast, all rights reserved. Please subscribe and share. Okay, until next time, keep it Florida, and we'll see you soon.